Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 199 for June 7th of 2013. Chrysler tells NHTSA to go pound sand. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Peter DeLorenzo, man, how are you?
Mr. McElroy, I'm good. How are
good.
You?
Good. I'm doing great. And we should introduce our other partners in crime with us tonight.
Yes, Mr. Gary Vasilash.
Peter, John.
Automotive Design and Production, Auto Field Guide, and Todd Lasso.
Peter, John.
Todd from Automobile.
Yes.
Good having you here. And you two just got back from Germany, right?
Did.
Yes. I mean, today?
No, it was yesterday.
Yesterday? Out driving semi-autonomous cars with Continental?
I got the exclusive drive. Sorry, Gary. I asked for it and I got it. Went back after the regular presentation and did a quick drive and wrote about it at automobilemag.com. And, you know, it's, on the other hand, Gary, it's an autonomous car. It's a self-driving car, so it's easy. It's like falling off a wall.
No hands?
No hands.
Yeah.
One thing I wrote was if you're an auto journalist and you write the review of the car while you're driving the car, is it still an auto review? I mean, you know, this is the future. If taken to its logical conclusion, if you believe our pal Jim Hall, its logical conclusion will eventually take the driver out altogether. Continental does not believe that. It believes that this will enhance your driving experience because you'll use it in traffic jams. You'll use it when you're driving through construction. You'll use it, crossing I-80 or, you know, vast expanses of wide open, straight, boring interstate. But if that's the case, more power to them.
Well, let's not forget that auto as an automobile, autonomous, right? So mm-hmm. It means without, basically, mm-hmm. intervention, right? So it would only be the natural culmination of it. So actually our steering and using pedals is an aberration. We should never be doing any of that. It should all be robotic. But
it's been something that, you know, has been discussed since at least the 1930s. But it certainly flies in the face of our enthusiasm.
But again, you know, you get the sense that there's a sensibility there in terms of the development that's going on that is largely focused on congested traffic that may be more characteristic of Europe than the United States, in that there's this sense of, you know, there was a big emphasis on safety, especially pedestrian safety. So they showed us systems that would automatically take control of the steering if you were about to run into some goofy-looking guy wearing a baseball cap. And, you know,
which
so it's just
a dummy they use.
Yes, and Gary, not an actual goofy-looking guy. But so it seemed to be all about, you know, we're driving in congested cities. Let's try to relieve some of the tedium on the driver. And, I mean, let's face it, if you're on the 405 during rush hour, you know, how enthusiastic can you be about driving under those conditions?
Yeah, go 20 feet, brake.
Well, but the other thing is that it also allows people who are already doing this, who are spending half their daily commutes texting, calling,
applying makeup,
eating breakfast, to do that much more safely. I tend to think of those people as the vast majority of Americans, in our case, who are non-enthusiasts, and given the choice, years down the road might say, I'm fine with the car always driving itself. So that's the question. That's the question, is what happens after this develops to its logical extent?
Well, the vast majority of people will opt to have their autonomous car that they never have to drive themselves again. And the 10% of the population that is a hardcore enthusiast, really enjoys driving, will never give it up. And that's the beauty of this autonomous technology, is you can have autonomous and non-autonomous cars interacting, you know, on the same roads with no problem. You know, remember, Google has now racked up 400,000 test miles of autonomous driving. They've only had one incident in that 400,000 miles, and that's when one of their people was actually driving the car. So the autonomous technology has never failed them yet. Now, that doesn't mean it's perfectly suitable to put in production right now. There's still some glitches with it.
Well, it tells you something about the level of drivers that Google hires, doesn't it? when they crash the autonomous car by driving it.
All the research shows that 95% of all traffic accidents are driver error. Mm-hmm. In some way, shape, or form.
Of course. Sure.
It's driver error. It's very rare for the car to fail. Very, very rare for the car to just give up the ghost and crash.
Yeah, precisely. Well, and, you know, the two biggest barriers right now, because the technology really is there now. Yes, they have to perfect it. They have to keep testing it before they can be sure to bring it out to the general public in large numbers. But, you know, we've all driven cars with adaptive cruise control and with lane departure control, right? It's logical to see that you could just take a few steps and be beyond lane departure control and have the car steer itself. Acura and Mercedes already have this 10-second rule where the car will steer on gentle curves. I'm talking about the new updated E-Class and the upcoming S-Class and the Acura RLX. So we know that it's not far away. The questions now are insurance, who's liable if there is an accident, if something goes wrong. The interesting thing about the Continental car, is that you set the autonomous driving, the automated driving, before you start out. It'll work at 0 miles per hour up to, 130 kilometers per hour, about 80 miles per hour. And it will, so you steer when you have that engaged, and when it finds an appropriate road, one that it can determine where to be in the lane and how to steer around it, you'll feel a tug, you'll feel torque on the steering wheel that lets you know that it's ready to take over if you so desire. So you let that happen. If you grab the wheel and overtake it, give it more torque than it's giving, it gives driving back to you. That, to me, is a pretty good way of getting past this whole idea of who's driving, who's responsible if there is an accident.
Well, there was another thing, remember, that we noticed about the situation, though, for these vehicles, is that, you know, we were out, I don't know how many miles away from Hanover, out at their, we were at their tire test facility.
Where, the Contadrome.
Contadrome, yes. And so even out in this, you know, hinterland, two-lane highway, great road markings. I mean, the side lines were white, the stripes down the middle.
As the Germans tend to do, right?
So basically, I mean, if you're developing this autonomous car that's using forward-looking cameras, it's going to see something. You know, you drive around here, and it's hit or miss, right? And so you'd have that whole problem. But I know that you're getting all agitated by this whole thing. But here's the good news. The head of powertrain for Continental said, so far as he's concerned, that for at least through 2030, the internal combustion engine will reign supreme. So there's still hope.
However, I asked Alfred Eckert, the head of the basically big R&D chief on this program. I said, does autonomy, once we have full autonomy, is that the last nail in the coffin of the traditional manual transmission? He said yes.
Yeah, you can't have autonomous cars
with three pedals and a
yeah. stick shift. Well, you could, but it would all be done underneath, you know, the floor pan.
It just wouldn't make sense.
So it would be automatic.
So, yeah, right.
But
why have a manual when the computer is going to do the shifting?
Right. So, but can you imagine, you know, open the car door, Hal. Sorry, Dave.
So, Todd, what's the deal with automobile? Did I miss the memo, or did they just come out with their 10 best?
With our All-Stars.
With the All-Stars. Isn't that usually in December?
Yeah, we moved it up, and this actually happened before I joined, because I moved from Motor Trend to Automobile at the end of November, and the decision had already been made. I just finished up with doing Motor Trend's Car of the Year, so I'm still kind of getting up to speed with that, but we decided to play it up in terms of doing an issue that was a little further out past the automobile of the year, which, of course, was the Tesla S this year. So we chose all-stars include the BMW 3 Series. I hope I can remember them all. The Honda Accord, Ford Focus. What am I missing? I'm missing a truck. The Ram pickup truck. And I caught myself before calling it the Dodge Ram.
It's still the Dodge Ram. Damn it.
Oh, and the Audi. I should not forget the Audi A7.
Right.
So I think I've covered it there.
Yeah. Well, the 3 Series and the Accord have been on every year, right? Pretty sure.
I'm not sure. That's probably right. I should know this.
Your excuse being new to the magazine.
Okay, thank you.
You could probably tell us all the Motor Trend Car of the Year is far better than you could the All-Stars on Automobile.
Certainly the 12 I voted for, sure. Or voted against in some cases.
Hey, going back to this autonomous stuff, Peter, you wrote all about branding in your column this week. How would you brand autonomy? I mean, the public doesn't even know the word autonomous car yet, I don't think. I think it'll catch on, but I don't know if that's the right word to use with them.
Well, you have to kind of step back because the brands that are powerful today will be powerful in the future unless they screw up. And whether or not that particular brand is autonomous or not, you still have to have the brand. Autonomy will not be a brand unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be. The technology will be part of the cocktail that comes with your vehicle out in the driveway, but you're still going to buy whatever you want. You're still going to buy an Infiniti. You're still going to buy a BMW or a Cadillac or a Ford. You know, autonomy will not be a brand unto itself.
And they'll all have their own names, like Cadillac's doing Super Cruise. I think, is Mercedes called Stop and Go, the first step, this E and S class thing?
I think it's called No, I think it's...
I think it's called Wing and a Prayer.
No, I think they've... It's like... It's not Distronic Plus, but I think Distronic is in there.
I think they've got a new name for the.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and I thought it was Stop and Go. I was there for the launch, and you know it was one of those generic enough names that I can't quite remember.
Mm-hmm.
There's too many of them. Peter, what do you think of Autopilot? That's been thrown out as a potential name, a canopy name for every brand's version of this.
I don't think it's bad. I think people have understand it and familiar with it with the aviation business. So, you know, and they all know the big jets that they are jammed into are flown on autopilot a lot. So I don't think that's a bad idea, really.
Autopilot sounds like something out of the 1930s.
Well,
that might not be a bad thing in making it
seem retro.
Safer.
Hey, like it's been around.
Very familiar.
Is that being bandied about by the industry as like everyone latches on to that?
I think that came up at last year, and there's one this coming week, the Autonomous Car Summit in Detroit. I attended part of it last year, and there was a discussion about that, and I can't remember who, but one expert suggested autopilot.
The mass media has often used the term robot car, which I don't like because, honest to God, to the general public, they think that there's going to be this robot android, you know, C-3PO at the wheel of their car. That's absolutely what they think. The robot's going to be driving the car.
Or the Terminator. Depending on what brand of car you
have. Well, and Hall always uses that example of the scene from, is it the Terminator, where he gets into a Johnny cab and there's a robot driving the car, like you would need that.
Well, the best part was when Arnold Schwarzenegger, as a Terminator,
element.
Comes into the truck and says, "Get out." The guy just jumps up. "Get out." Takes one look at him and, okay. I think he actually throws him out, though.
I think we have a long time before we have to worry about the branding of this technology. I
think it's going to come far faster than you guys do.
I agree with you, John. I think we're going to see elements of it just in a few years.
The stepping stones towards it.
Oh, I think we have them right now.
We'll see it in
radar-based cruise control
urban centers. We'll see it in big urban centers first.
But I think you'll see that about the same time you see all the Cyan IQs and smarts driving around in those urban centers too. So.
You may also see it in China first. I mean, it's very logical for China having automobiles is kind of the infrastructure for automobiles is relatively new in China. They're building new megacities. They're talking about this as being a megacity sort of thing.
Well, that might make sense so that the people won't have to worry about driving through the coal-fired haze. Just put it on autopilot because they can't right. see or breathe anyway. So.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And then, you know, you also have to think about the expense. I mean, so as cars right now become increasingly expensive. I mean, so you add this stuff to something and it's going to be
very expensive.
Very expensive.
Well, you know, right now it is, but there's a couple of things that I think would mitigate that. Number one is if you have an autonomous car that can't get in an accident, and we're already seeing it with this automatic braking system that Volvo has, which I think is a Continental technology,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. The city safety.
I mean, IIHS, you know, the Insurance Institute and everyone is saying they see noticeable reductions in accidents with Volvos with that technology. And so you can get an insurance discount if you've got that on your car. I think the same thing's going to happen with autonomous cars, too. You're going to get a discount. And then secondly is, think about the logical conclusion, as you say, Jim Hall is talking about, where right now in the United States, we have households which have a car for every licensed driver. But if we've got autonomous cars in the future that can take dad to work in the morning and come back and then take the kids to school and come back and then take mom shopping, or maybe it takes mom to work and dad go shopping. Mm-hmm. Now you can have maybe one car per household. And, you know, I would say the average household, even with used cars, is spending several thousand dollars a year on each and every one of those cars.
True.
So you whittle that down to one or two cars per household, and all of a sudden they start saving $6,000-$8,000 a year by doing that. This technology could pay for itself very quickly.
And then the body material could be saran wrap because you never get into an accident. So
but the other
tissue
question,
paper.
Yeah.
The other question, but it's not waterproof. See, saran wrap right. would be
also would.
The other question is, how does this fit into the other trends of A, young people not getting their driver's licenses right away, and B, the talk of not owning a car, of depending on ride sharing or car sharing, you know, just like the bike programs in New York and Paris. I mean, how does autonomy fit into that?
Well, we have a generation of kids who've been driven around.
That's why they need the robot car.
I'll tell you why kids aren't interested in cars right now, because they can't afford them. They can't get a job and they can't afford it. The insurance is prohibitive for them. And so it's human nature. When you cannot afford something, you tell all your friends, you know, I'm not interested in that. I don't really care about that.
Yeah, but
that.
We couldn't afford anything. We still had aspirations for it. The aspiration isn't there.
The aspiration is not there.
That they can't afford it, or that they're spending the money on these things instead?
Yeah, iPads.
Well, this turns them on more than...
Sure it does. But you watch, as the economy continues to recover, as these young people decide to get married and have kids and, you know, household formation, mm-hmm. they are going to have a car. They're just going to have one.
But this gets to the point. The car that they're going to have, does this then just become utility, or is this something that's desirable or aspirational? And I think to your point that we once desired and aspired to having cars. But if we get married and we have kids and we need to cart the kids to daycare and to soccer practice and so on and so on and so on, that's just basically a utility device, the same way that the refrigerator serves the purpose of keeping our food cold and the washing machine keeps our clothes clean.
Yeah.
And the furnace keeps our house at a reasonable temperature. So it's not something like, oh, my God, I just can't wait till I get that new Rheem furnace. Man, that thing is sweet.
And even but even if it's a car that you want to be proud to put in front of your house, if you, just as most young people today don't learn how to drive stick shift, will you be able to buy one of those, I'm talking 20, 30, 40 years from now, and not even have to learn how to drive and still have it?
30, 40 years from now, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I believe that. But getting back to what you said, Gary, I don't think it's necessarily either or. It's not like they're going to become passionate about cars or they're just going to look at it as a utility. That's going on already right now today. I would say the vast majority of people who buy a new car love buying a new car. And then there's general degrees or varying degrees of, you know, hardcore enthusiasts who are, you know, this is, you know, a highlight of their life, and other consumers who are just proud to own a new car, but it's not like they're emotionally attached to it. They're just pleased they got a new set of wheels. And I think as younger people who say today they're not interested in cars, you know, form households, have children, you know, all of a sudden have a whole lot more driving or, you know, mobility needs. As they start shopping for cars, they'll start to get into it. They'll start to get excited. Ooh, which model should I get? What features should I buy? What, you know, as they start to research it, I think a lot of them will start to be interested in, ooh, what set of wheels should I
see? I think they're just all going to look on Craigslist and just see what they can get for the you know, the cheapest beater they can possibly get because, you know, they want a new phone. And there's a new data program that they just have to have with their phone. And I think it'll be all of that. I just don't see it.
That's why automakers are putting so much concentration now on the center stack and how that ties in with your iPhone or your iPad or your Android or whatever, and that may work. There's also all these data of how young people aren't interested in starting out in a Chevy or Ford or Toyota. They want to go straight to the aspirational brands. Maybe some are waiting for that, hoping that they'll someday have an income that will make that work.
So they sit in their bedrooms and wait.
Well, they sit in their bedrooms and they wait, and they rather than going out with friends, they interact with them on Facebook or Twitter or whatever makes Facebook and Twitter look like old fogey sites now. You know.
Well, we're definitely going through a noticeable societal change on all this, so. I still think it will impact the auto industry within the next decade. Yeah. But it's not as if the auto industry is going to go away or suffer badly. I think it will put a cap on growth.
Well,
the total car park.
It might be the LED light bulb analogy.
What do you mean?
Well, you can buy these LED light bulbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't burn out.
Right.
They last beyond your lifetime. And what you said with the autonomous car, you know, the need for three or four aspirational vehicles might go away. I mean, we have that thing in the garage that takes us where we need to go. Yeah, it's a cap, all right, and it could be a gradual decrease. I mean, yeah, the population, they'll buy more,
right.
but eventually it'll just stop.
It will stop, and I think we'll see it plateau in this country sometime in the next decade. But what I think autonomy will do is change the passion for cars, because what I see happening is once you have a fully autonomous car that can take you everywhere, you don't need a steering wheel, out it goes. You don't need pedals, out they go. You don't need tachometers, speedometers, all they go. You don't even have to have the seats face forward. And if you get to the point a number of decades down the road, you know, where everyone's got autonomous technology, now you can start to take massive structure out of the car because you don't have to worry about it crashing. But what I'm getting at is the interior becomes far more important than it is right now from an aspirational standpoint. I see coach makers making a big comeback 30 years hence,
mm-hmm.
because you're going to want your own customized interior or your own beautiful interior, whether it's a den or a multimedia center or a little kitchen or it's got a cot or whatever the hell it's got inside. I think that the coach works will become preeminent again because you're going to be selling the inside of the car and everything that you can do in there.
Well, so Airstream should hook up with the manufacturer now.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely foresee literally packs of autonomous RVs with retirees in them traveling all across the country.
Wow.
Didn't Freeman Thomas did a
the Airstream concept.
Airstream concept for Ford. Yeah.
And Ralph.
Get back
Ralph.
At it.
See, but I see it rather than somebody like that. I see it as Steelcase needs to get into the car business and begin to provide furniture. Ergonomically designed furniture for your...
Yeah, I think more like Ethan Allen or, you know, something like that. Nothing too industrial.
Kind of like an Eames chair, yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that. John, do you think the U.S. market's just going to continue to hover around 15 million no matter what the population?
No. In 2009, when everything was crashing and everyone said, this is the end of the industry as we know it, I said, it will come back. And we'll go on to break all sales records. And I
really?
Still believe that's going to happen.
So you think we could reach 20 million?
I don't know about 20, because I used to believe that. But as you get into the car sharing and as autonomous comes on, it may hold it back. But think of it this way. The population of the United States goes up by 2 million people a year. Mm-hmm. In 10 years, we'll add 20 million people. Just out of that group alone, 1 million of them a year will go into the market and buy a new car.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and that's a pattern that's held true since the Great Depression. Year in and year out, 5% of America goes out and buys a new car.
Mm-hmm.
In a recession year, it might go down to 4%. In a boom year, it might go up to 6%. But pretty much year in, year out, 5% go out and buy a new car.
On the other hand, and when I say hover around 15 million, I mean, you know, maybe we'd have a high in the 17s or 18s
mm-hmm.
and a low in recession years in the 11s or 12s or even lower.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about how that 15 million number has been kind of the number with those, the kind of median number, if you will, since, what, about 1970? I mean, we've had it go up and down.
Oh, no. I mean, we didn't hit even 15 million until about 1978.
78.
And that was, 78 was an all-time record at that time of about 15 million. And then we hit 17 million plus 2005, six, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's when anybody could get credit. You know, they're just free credit for everybody. And the big three, the Detroit three, because they had so much overcapacity, had incentives going like crazy on these vehicles.
Sure.
So all that's gone.
Especially on the truck.
But I'd say the more normal level, and remember, we're still at, you know, what, 8% unemployment in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's counting the people who are still looking for a job. You know, you count the ones who have given up and the unemployment rate's even higher. So if we get back to a normal unemployment rate, that alone is going to push the U.S. market to a 16.5. Then you start throwing population growth on top of that. You're into the 17.5, 18 million. So I think 17 million is probably going to be a more normal level for the industry to settle into.
I'm not so sure that the new normal in terms of unemployment rate is not 7 or 8%.
It could be.
I think given, you know, whether it's developments in terms of technology or whether it's developments in terms of other countries manufacturing more product or, you know, I mean, just and service industries as well. I mean,
and a lot of industries finding they can hire people as freelancers, if you will.
Yeah.
Whatever the
sort of like our industry,
yeah, like our industry, whatever industry's version of freelancer or contract employee is, without getting into all the benefits.
Yeah, so I think the 4% unemployment rate as being full employment is gone.
I always thought full employment was about 6%. That's 4%. Well, 4% is what we had in the boom of the
90s.
Clinton years, early Bush years,
right.
But that was actually overemployment. I mean, just because of the population, because of the turnover in jobs in general,
mm-hmm.
people actually wanting to quit their job and find new ones, I think it's closer to 6 at this population. But anyway, we're getting way off this.
Yeah.
Like the cars, aren't we?
Right. So let's go to cars. What do y'all think of the Chevy SS being priced at $45,000?
Wow. I was floored when I saw that price. If you think about where the Pontiac G8 was, and of course the Pontiac G8 was available with a V6, which I think far outsold the V8 in that car, And with discounts, the ATPs were probably somewhere in the mid to upper 20s on that car a few mm-hmm. years ago.
And it was a terrific car.
It was a very good car. It needed a different interior, I think. But you know, one better suited for the U.S. market. But it was a good, very good car.
So, Peter, what do you think? $45,000 for a Chevy?
A Chevy sedan.
Well, let's see. It's rear-wheel drive.
Mm-hmm.
It's got how much? 420 horsepower V8. It's got a lot of stuff on it.
I know. It has everything that I'd want on the checklist. But can you have a bow tie on the grill and charge that kind
question.
Of money?
What about a Corvette?
How the enthusiasts out there... I mean, let's face it, it's the enthusiasts out there who want a V8 and rear-wheel drive. And then when they go shop a 3 Series, they actually have the SS on their consideration list. What's the percentage of...
Yeah.
Not very big.
Right. No, Gary raises a great question. I mean, Corvettes are even already more expensive. But I don't know. I'd say it's traditional.
And how many halo cars can
Corvette will bring people into a Chevrolet store who otherwise would never step foot in it?
But don't you think that the SS conceivably could have the same effect on the guys who are more interested in muscle cars rather than in sports cars? That Chevy then has something that is supplemental to the Camaro in some regards,
sort of like Camaro's. People buying the Chrysler,
Charger, Dodge. Charger and Challenger are doing very well.
The sub niche,
right?
But to your point, the Dodge Charger is you can have it with a Hemi and decent amount of kit, maybe not as much as the Super Sport, but for much less money, you can get one with a V8 for under $35,000. You can get a Camaro with a V8 and a little bit of equipment in the low 30s. And Chevrolet has made no bones about the fact that, Mark Royce especially, that this is going to be a low-volume car.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like it's a homologation for the NASCAR stock car, isn't it?
Like the old days.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the price is crazy, but, you know, I don't know the big scheme of things within General Motors. And even if it is a low-volume car, it's coming out of Holden in Australia. And maybe that's just enough to help keep Holden profitable. And so it makes sense to do this thing. And so you have this great halo, and you never worry about selling a whole lot of them.
Yeah, let's not forget the effect of Ford pulling out of the Australian
market. Poor bastards who work for Ford in Australia are going, damn.
Yeah, and, hurts the supply chain for Australian production, which now will be, after 2016, will be General Motors, Holden, and Toyota.
Right. Yeah. And that's what hurt Ford, was never really doing much of any export out of there. But, yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting.
So, John, what about your friends at NHTSA?
Oh, those guys. Well, that's a great one. You know, them telling Chrysler, recall 2.7 million Jeeps.
Well, I put on a site that good for Chrysler. Good. They just said, how about no?
Yeah.
What?
Right. Well, I didn't know this before. Bloomberg dug this up. Chrysler actually fought NHTSA in court in the late 1990s. And NHTSA forced Chrysler to do a recall. They refused to do it. It went to court. Chrysler lost. They appealed and won. And what I didn't know, I found this fascinating. The lawyer representing Chrysler at the time is John Roberts, now the Supreme Court Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. So just kind of interesting. I think Chrysler's on pretty solid ground. I don't think this is a frivolous, you know, forget it, we're not going to do it. I don't think this is frivolous at all. But, you know, NHTSA, what a track record. You know, Audi's coming out with these new laser kind of headlamps that they've got in Europe.
Giant lasers.
To go with your robot car.
But NHTSA's like, oh, no, we've got to study this thing. And I remember in the 1970s when we went from round incandescent headlamps to square ones, NHTSA agonized for several years, wringing their hands. Oh, is this safe to do? Can we possibly? And tested it, you know, Forever. Forever they tested this thing. And all we did was go from round to square. So when I hear them, you know, stiff-arming Audi on this, telling Chrysler they've got to recall it, and there's no defect. I mean, they admit there's no defect to it, what I should say is...
It's just the placement of the fuel tank.
Well, we need to know about these accidents because, yeah, a dozen people have died, and that is bad, and that's terrible, but... You know, were they rear-ended at 100 miles an hour or what? I mean, what's gone on in these things?
It looks like that. How,
there comes a point where I don't care what amount of safety equipment you put on a car, people are going to get killed anyway.
But what does this do to the image, though, of Chrysler? Especially, it seemed a little curious to me that they came out with a recall today of 181,000 SUVs due to premature wear due to a transmission oil cooler line. Unaware of any accidents or injuries associated with this issue, and 254,400 SUVs in the U.S. to upgrade software that controls restraint system function in certain types of accidents. Blah, 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 blah. The Chrysler Group is unaware of any injuries, accidents, or complaints associated with this issue. So Chrysler...
Well, there's a difference, Gary, is that, you know, with the fuel tank issue, they're fending off the potential for lawsuits, which... could be huge. I mean, let's not forget what Clarence Ditlow said. You know, don't get me started on him, but... He's already...
Oh, come on, go ahead.
he's already comparing this to the Pinto crashes saying, well, the difference is people ride in the back of Jeep Grand Cherokee.
Look, I just wish the media would identify Clarence Ditlow for what he is. Not a safety advocate. This guy is a front for the plaintiff attorneys. Mm-hmm. All they do is, him and all the other safety advocates, is dig up information to sell to plaintiff attorneys who can then use that in lawsuits against the car companies. In fact, the car companies even buy these guys' material so they can know how to prepare for their defense. And it's also such a scam, I think.
He's also shilling for the insurance industry, which can then raise insurance rates on all manner of Jeep Grand Cherokee, right?
Well, look, you know, the insurance guys tend to side with the plaintiffs, not the OEMs, because they don't want to make any payments. If they can blame any problem on the car companies, they don't have to pay out.
Exactly.
And I'm not trying to exonerate the car companies and everything that they do, but, I mean, tort in this country is out of control. It's like when electronic throttle control first came out, anti-lock brakes first came out, electronic stability control. It didn't come out in this country first. Why? And talk to the Mercedes and the BMWs and the Audis and all these guys who pioneered this technology. They know they're going to get sued when they come to the United States.
Which brings us back to autonomous cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who the hell is going to be brave enough here to put one on the road?
Well, and yet...
it's sold to us.
Yeah, but
and yet
not...
Continental is now saying that they see the legislative path as being easier...
In the U.S.
In the U.S. than in,
right.
in Western Europe.
Right. But that's the legislative path.
Right.
The legal path is going to be different in this country. And just as I said before, you know, ABS, electronic stability control, electronic throttle control, was first developed, or used, I should say, in Europe... because they want to have a body of evidence that shows, look, we've used it in these countries and and it all works. So when they get sued in the United States, they can bring in this body of evidence to help defend themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's like with airbags, you know, there was a big question, who's liable in that? Well, it turns out not only is the car company liable, so is the airbag company. And so when TRW first started making airbags back in the 90s, every airbag that went out the door, they put a dollar in the kitty, in the legal defense fund kitty, because they knew where they were going to get sued. And I think the same thing will happen with autonomous cars. They may have to put $10 for every car that goes out, but, you know, there's too much money to be made in this. They're not going to hold back and go, oh, we're not putting it out there because we might get sued. They just got to figure out how they're going to defend themselves in court.
What else are we going to cover?
What else are we going to cover here today? I saw the new Malibu last week, and I think that's a good discussion. And in fact, I'd be curious about some of your input too, Gary, because we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. How would we redesign the Malibu?
Yeah, and I remember Peter's recommendation was start over again, right?
Well, saw it off at the B pillar. and have one group of guys do the front all in the whole car instead of knocking off for lunch halfway through. I don't think the back end goes with the rest of the car.
No, it doesn't.
I like the redo of the front.
Here's Ben's got the, and Carmen have got the pictures up there. And I do like the redo of the fascia. And the other thing that's kind of interesting, look how on the new one, how much farther out the hood seems to jut.
Yeah.
And how it, to use their terminology, how it shingles over the top part of the grill. And yet the hood's identical, old and new.
Wow.
And it's just a really nice styling trick that didn't cost a whole lot of money. And when you look at those fascias, you can see it's the bottom part of the grill right under the bow tie. All they had to do was really modify that part of the fascia. And none of these changes affect crash, so they didn't have to re-crash the vehicle. And the engine powertrain improvements that they did not affect emissions, so they didn't have to recertify. So I just think this is a good example of how you can get a fairly significant change in the way a car looks without spending a fortune.
Now, I think the more important thing for this car, and I think we've talked about this before, how the new Honda Accord, by going back to old Honda ways, has that expansive DLO and that you can sit in the back seat and feel like you're not, you know, in a cave or something like that. They weren't able to do anything with the DLO, the rear quarters of this car, but they did play with the seat height and the seat pad, I believe, to give it a little bit more room back there.
And they gained a little over an inch of knee room by scalloping out the backs of the front seats and taking a little bit of foam out of the back seat. So you pick up a little room that way. But you're right. They couldn't change the DLO. That would have required tooling.
Yeah, I mean, there are no hard points changed, obviously.
Right, none.
But in that case, they also suffer the same problem that, you know, to a lesser extent, the Ford Fusion has, and yet it's a much more successful design out of the box. But again, I think with what Honda has done with this Accord and how others can follow in the near future, the Toyota Corolla, a different segment, of course, but you look at the design for the Furia, the concept car, and they're kind of doing the same thing. And I think this gets back to, you know, if you're doing a compact or midsize sedan, design it from the inside out so that the people in the back seat feel that they're riding in something, you know, decent, that capacious and comfortable. Don't try to make it look too sporty because it's never going to be a sporty car.
Yeah.
But I mean, isn't the Malibu been suffering over the last couple of years because, especially since the Fusions arrived on the scene, that it looks sort of fuddy-duddy and it could have the most remarkable interior known to man, and people would just see it in the showroom, and then they'd see that Fusion drive by, and they'd say, "What the hell is that?"
Yeah, but the last Malibu actually looked nice. It looked like a nicer car than, you know, it looked like it was something more than a Chevy in terms of.
I agree. I mean, it certainly upped its game immeasurably from where it had been. But then you know, the competitor comes out and it just, you know, throws down this trump card that just completely changes the game.
Yeah, Mark Roy said that the Malibu was the last car they worked on before the company went into bankruptcy.
Right, right.
And that's why, you know, they didn't like the way it came out. But, Peter, when you and I first saw that thing, what was it, 3 years ago or something?
Longer than that.
Was it longer than that? It was like both of us said, boy, that thing's a little too busy design-wise.
Yeah, the first redo.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, you know, we should probably devote a whole show sometime to our ideas of how to refresh designs without spending a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Malibu is down 18.4% so far this year compared to last year. And in the last month, it was down 36% compared to last year.
Well, the other thing is this, really. I mean, GM cut the divisions in the bankruptcy. But in essence, they're still fighting the same thing because they've just brought out the Impala, which is attractive. And you can get a decent Impala for not much money. To me, the Impala has made the Malibu redundant.
Oh, interesting.
Well, because they have the cruise. Hmm. And now, don't forget, the Malibu and the Impala inside, aren't they the same width car?
Are they?
I think I got to look that up.
Isn't it? But it's not.
The same, no, the cruise and the Malibu are on the same platform.
Well, yeah,
cruise is on Delta.
But the Malibu and the Impala interior are unbelievably close. Now, they've done things in the Impala to make it look roomier, and it might be a fraction of an inch, but it's not a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking,
well, it's the Malibu and
because the Impala's longer.
Yeah, the Impala's longer, but I'm talking actual cabin room. So, you know, and I said on the site, if I'm GM, I put the Malibu on the shelf and put all the money in marketing that Impala, because with the cruise, they're stepping on each other.
So is this sort of so the Malibu is going to have the Buick Regal problem?
Yes.
Oh, no question. I mean, the cruise is a large compact. The Malibu is a small midsize car, and then the Impala is a full size car. I don't know. I'd have to compare the back seat of the Impala. I thought it was quite a bit larger. They're both on the FC2 platform.
I know it's not wider. It's not dramatically wider on the inside of the car.
Okay, I'll buy
that. Interesting.
But it has a more expansive DLO I was talking about. But the other thing, the problem now too, is that the segment in which the Impala plays should be a much more expensive car than the Malibu. The Malibu ATP should be somewhere in the mid-20s. The Impala playing up against the Toyota Avalon and the Ford Taurus should be at least in the low 30s, maybe mid-30s. The problem they've had is with that old Impala going forth, they've always been competing with the Malibu in the same dealership. Hey, for a few bucks more, wouldn't you like a full-sized Impala?
Well, but the Impala is certainly more of a design statement.
Of course.
Even over the freshened Malibu.
Well, in fact, I thought it was sort of funny that they get a much better ATP on the car.
They were talking about the new design of the front end of the Malibu resembling the Impala.
The Impala, right.
You know, I mean, it's just like, wow, how did that happen so rapidly? Cafaro's working some magic over there.
That's right. But, you know, you raise a really interesting point. I'd love to match up car line by car line, brand by brand, because, let's see, Chevy's got Spark, Sonic, Cruise, Malibu, Impala, and SS. So six cars in there. Ford's got Fiesta, Focus, Fusion, Taurus, right? Mm-hmm. Am I missing any? So there's four.
Yeah.
So, they might be trying to slice the market a little too thinly at Chevrolet.
Well, when you're in an all-out fight with the competitors, I mean, I think fewer, better vehicles can be marketed better. And first of all, if they are better vehicles, which I think the new Impala is really quite
good. It's a good car, right.
And the Volt.
Oh, the Volt. You're right. Very good, Gary.
Yeah. I mean, the Impala, I think the word of the mouth on the Impala when it gets out, you know, we always have to, everything we say, I mean, Detroit is a warped society. I mean, you see new stuff and, you know, we're so jaded by the time, oh, yeah, I've seen the Impala. It still hasn't been out in Colorado or, you know, and once it hits the streets around, I think people are going to really like
They'll notice it.
Just like people are, guess what? People like the MKZ.
Yeah.
They had never even seen it before. They've read all about it and, you know, the magazines talked about it 6 months ago. It's just hitting the streets in any sort of volume right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's not a good car, Peter, but I think with what they're trying to do with it, with what they've
C-Max,
the monthly money they put into
they
it,
consider that
they
car.
Better be getting a much higher ATP with it. That's the success, if they sell it in that $35,000 range instead of, you know, a few bucks more per month than a Malibu.
So I think GM's going to have, we're going to run into a problem.
Mm-hmm. Gary just reminded me of a few more cars, too. Mustang Camaro, Volt for Chevrolet as well.
C-Max
at Ford. And
I think that was it.
Yeah, they've got pretty full lineups.
Yeah. Hey, good time to take a quick commercial break and come back and do rapid fire. Carmen, let's go to give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. We're just going to jump right into it. Don Braun says, the GTO made in Australia was a flop because it wasn't American. Will the Chevy SS also flop? Will GM never learn? I'm not sure. I don't believe that the GTO flopped because it was Australian. I think they took, what was it, the Holden Monaro, right? and they rushed it into production as a GTO.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, GTO. Yeah. And they needed to make a whole lot more changes to the car. The second iteration was a damn good car.
Well, it's a damn good car, but, I mean, the people who were buying GTOs were too invested in the original car. And so there was always a disconnect. I mean, yeah, at the end, it was a great car. You want V8 and 6-speed and good handling, but was it a Pontiac GTO? No.
There's long been this kind of vague promise, not quite stated, going back to the Lutz years and the GTO, that at some point the Zeta, you know, Zeta platform mm-hmm. that underpins all those Holdens would be worked into American-designed and built Chevy sedans, Pontiac sedans, maybe a Buick sedan, and be better suited for the U.S. market, and they've never gotten there. The styling, the Holden styling in recent years on the rear-drive cars leaves me kind of cold. It's a little bit...
It's generic.
Generic.
Yeah, it's very generic.
And, you know, with just some new sheet metal and an interior that is designed for the U.S. I mean, for example, the Pontiac G8 had all of its power window controls in the center, and I don't know about Chevy SS might. I haven't seen, I don't know.
I'll bet it does.
I bet it does, because you're talking about a right-hand drive car and a left-hand drive car.
Exactly.
Don't forget, too, you're talking about Holden exports. They've been exporting those cars to the Middle East as
forever.
Chevys and now a Buick Park Avenue in China,
right.
Based on the Holden.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And don't forget part of the problem that, you know, G8 comes out and then the whole world changes, right? I mean, you have 2008, 2009, and what happens to sales of anything, right?
Yeah, but remember they were going to bring in did they come up with a name for the El Camino version they were going to bring in, and then they decided not to bring in even before the economy imploded? That was...
I remember staying next to John Lochner at the New York show. I've told this story before, and they were, you know, we were watching the roll, you know, the reveal of this, and John said, "What do you think?" "It'll never see the light of day, John." And I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Come on, man."
I remember you saying that. Let's see. Kurt Wiley wants to know, what do you Autoline enthusiasts think Subaru needs to do to get more brand presence, let alone register on the auto extremist brand image meter? Do they need a big hairy V8 in the engine bay? DSG transmissions, more radical if impractical styling?
You know, the thing about Subaru is they know their market. I wouldn't change a thing.
They shouldn't do a damn thing. They're setting sales records.
Yeah. They are brilliant.
They know what they're doing, know who their buyers are. And, you know, the whole rally car thing was just a niche of a niche, and they don't need it.
They are the successful Saab. They're doing what Saab wanted to do, continue to be a niche brand for people who were big enthusiasts of the brand and still grow it. They've managed to do what Saab could never do.
They're brilliant. I'm stunned by the success of that company. They blow me away.
I haven't looked at their loyalty rate, but I bet you it's extremely high.
There was only 10 or 12 years ago that Mitsubishi sold more cars in the U.S. than Subaru did.
Yeah.
So speaking of Swedish cars, Peter, have you seen the new Volvo commercial where they're basically saying we're not for everybody and we like it that way?
Yeah. Well, like I said, my brand... Auto Extremist brand image meter. I just said their Volvo's still a car for people who don't understand why they have to have a car or something like that.
They should make autonomous vehicles.
Well, they walked away from their safety positioning. Never should have done that. Mm-hmm. I mean, because even though safety became kind of the price of entry, they still owned it.
Absolutely.
And they could just say, well, we're still, we were about safety when it wasn't cool. And we're so far out ahead of everyone else. And they walked away from it. It's just like, what?
Yeah. Big mistake. Ken S. from Laveen, Arizona says, Motorweek just named my Hyundai Accent the best subcompact car. What the heck has happened to definitions and standards? I think my Accent is on the rather large size, both inside and out, and the weight is up there, too. It's huge compared to my 84 Civic, which probably weighed 800 to 900 pounds less than the Accent.
an 84 Civic weighed 800 to 900 pounds less than just about anything. I mean, if you look at the size of cars and the weight of cars these days versus...
Wasn't the 84 Civic like 2,200 pounds?
I'm sorry, did you say 84 or 94?
84.
Well, I had the 87 CRX based off that platform, and it was 1,800 pounds. So, yeah, 22, 23, somewhere in there. You know, the original Volkswagen GTI weighed 1,800 pounds. Now it's not far short of 3,000 pounds.
I love the original GTI.
And I would suspect that the Civic today is probably bigger than the 84 Accord that I had. So
probably.
That's right.
And, you know, it's unfair to compare cars to, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. What am I saying?
Yeah, because the current 5 Series BMW is as big as the 7 was not too long ago.
Yeah.
And the 3 Series is as big as the 5 was.
And you know, in the Hyundai lineup, I mean, that is the subcompact because the Elantra is the compact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's its positioning.
Yeah. Let's see. Abhi says, I saw the new Cadenza, and man, I really love it. Looks solid and nice clean lines. But when I saw that gear shift knob, that looks so cheap, they should change that. Why not go after an Audi A8 type design? After all, the designer is Peter Schreier. I don't remember the gear shift knob
either.
on the Cadenza.
Do you remember it?
I don't remember it either. I mean,
clearly it wasn't bad enough for us to call out.
Well, Kia could make it look the same as an Audi gear shift. It could use the same design, but it still wouldn't look like an Audi gear shift. It would have a different texture and material to it. I mean, you know.
Okay, here's an advertising one. Mepco Re7, I hope I said that right, says, every automaker has used dogs to sell cars for years. Think Subaru and their dog ads, and now Lincoln has an ad that is anti-dog. Does that just prove how off-base Lincoln is? I haven't seen that ad.
No, I mean, that just, you know, Lincoln is kind of the march to a different drummer luxury brand. I mean, they were nowhere. So they're taking some chances, and not all that's going to be well received. But
is that taking a chance or is it desperation, do you think?
I don't think it's desperation. I think, you know, they're in it for the long haul, and I think they need a big Lincoln, okay? But in the meantime, they've got the MKZ, which is finally rolling out. I think the MKC is going to be very well received.
I agree.
And that's going to buy them time until they get the big one. But they need the big one to be a drop-dead, OMG, did you see that new Lincoln kind of car?
And it's got to be big.
And it's got to be big, and it's got to look great.
Peter, do you think the chances for a big rear-drive Lincoln are greater or less now that Ford of Australia is going away?
Oh, I think it's on target simply because of the new Mustang coming.
Okay.
I mean, they will start with that platform and tweak.
So I want to know about this anti-dog. What, does that big hawk come down and grab a dog or something and fly away with it? Or?
Do they try to run them over with a Lincoln? That would be pretty awful.
You know.
Certainly won't be buying one in my household, that's for sure.
No.
Not that I could afford it, but.
I haven't seen the ad, so I can't comment on it. Anyway, here we got another question. John Manoogian wrote in, anyone read Lutz's new book, Icons and Idiots?
I did.
I haven't read it.
Oh, you read it, huh?
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Tell us, Gary.
Okay.
I love this pause.
There's your review right there.
No, I think if it wasn't written by Lutz, no one would have any interest in this book.
Hmm.
The amount of interest would be zero. And so the title of the book is Icons and Idiots, okay? And so he talks about a number of people, Lee Iacocca and Rick Wagner's in there. And
he basically said Rick was too nice of a guy.
So the thing comes out is that, you know, the number of, so these are, you know, he starts out with his school teacher in middle school and, you know, I mean, all the way through his drill instructor in the Marine Corps. Blah, blah, blah. So the guys who you start reading are idiots. By the time you get to the end of the chapter, they're pretty smart guys. Like all of them.
Yeah.
It's just like, So it's like, you know, as you get
old,
as you get older, you get more tolerant of people. You know what I mean? And
even
so,
us. And I mean, yeah, didn't we already know that about Rick Wagner, by the way, that he was too nice a guy? You know, but the more important thing was that he never conceived of oil ever going above $100 a barrel.
That's not
or whatever.
Part of it. Come on.
Well, okay.
But I mean, just talking about the way they are. You know, I mean, it's like what they were like to work with, and on and on and on. And then, you know, so he gets to the he gets to the end, and he goes.
By the way, I just have to say that my wife texted me that Lincoln must be for cat people.
Oh.
Well, that could be.
By the way, we'll have Lutz here on After Hours next month. So
I better read the book.
So, yeah, I was surprised.
How he softened up at the end of each chapter?
Yeah, because in his... Car Guys and Bean Counters, I think that was the name of the previous book.
Right, yeah.
You know, and he's quite strident throughout, mm-hmm. right? And in this one, I'm just, like, just waiting. You know, just,
yeah.
Huh?
What did he say about Whitaker? Did he say anything? Because Whitaker pretty much puts him down in his book.
I don't recall that he even mentions it.
Really? Mm-hmm. Did he say anything about Ackerson?
I don't recall it.
Yeah, he never really worked for Ackerson, so he may not have anything there. But Whitaker, his book, he says, the only thing I thought Bob Lutz's job was at General Motors was going around telling people his opinion. I thought that was a pretty good slap.
Whitaker had a couple of passages in his book where it was, you know, this was nice to have, but we were in trouble and we couldn't afford that guy, you know, sort of thing. And there was a couple of those in there. And I think that if you really look at it, we perhaps knew who he was talking about. But if somebody sitting in Kansas was reading the book, they, you know, who's he talking about? It doesn't matter. You know, it's a little inside. But
Lutz's response to Whitaker should have been, well, yeah, GM needs more people to come around and give him straight opinions, you know.
Well, actually, he did put out a statement reminding everybody that Whitaker only worked at the company 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a pretty good slap back.
Yeah.
You know, here's this
very good,
very, you know, big Texan who's going to come in and save GM and gets up one morning and quits.
Well, remember the name of his book, American Turnaround. So it's like, you know, who made that happen?
Yeah. Okay, one last question, then we'll call it a show. VRM Chris heard us talk at all about Impala and all that. He says, given that the Impala overlaps the Malibu significantly, should GM reconsider the Holden Commodore going front-wheel drive in 2017 and have the platform stay rear drive and then have the Impala be rear drive as well?
It's a tough thing in Australia. I mean, they have I'm not completely familiar with it, but they've got issues with fuel efficiency and cost and so on as well, so...
Well, I just, you know, GM has never, I mean, the SS moniker has only worked to me when it's attached to a car name.
Like Chevelle.
Yeah. Now, you know, they could have called this SS something else, Impala SS, Chevelle SS, something like that, or drop the Malibu and put the Malibu on that. But
call it the SS Ackerson.
That would be good.
Oh, Ben just... gave me the high sign that they can play a couple of the phoners that came in. So let's bring the first one in.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. And looking at the May sales numbers, Ford was really close to General Motors once again. My question for the panel is, does any member of the panel predict Ford will overtake GM in the U.S. market? Thanks.
Ooh, good question. How close were they, Gary? You got the numbers there?
I think they were that
240-something, I'm guessing.
Total vehicles, May, Ford, 246,585. And General Motors... $252,894.
That is close.
I think there was one month in 08 or 09 where Ford might have passed General Motors. And, and I think, you know, I think you might see it happen here and there. Again, I don't think it would ever be, I shouldn't say ever. No, never say never. But I think, at least in the short term, I don't see it as being permanent.
No, I don't either. And, you know, as we've talked about on the show, General Motors has something like 20 new models coming into the U.S., refreshed or redone. So I, you know, look, they're at the absolute bottom of their product cycle right now.
They are, yeah.
You know, and by the end of the year, they'll be at the top of their product cycle. So, and then they'll have all of next year, you know, full year selling it. So I'm glad this guy who called in, that's a great question. I didn't pick up on how close Ford had come to GM.
Well, I think, though, to be fair to General Motors, the power of the F-Series just is like a friggin' juggernaut.
I mean, force of nature.
It's absolutely. I mean, it's 71,604 F-Series were sold in May.
Wow.
And 43,000 Silverados and 16,000 Sierras. So, I mean, it's the, you know, the F brand is the F series brand. I mean, that's where all the power is. It's like right there.
Yeah. But you know, this gets back to our earlier discussion. Does GM have too many models still? You know, with two different trucks,
they do. Yeah.
They can barely touch Ford, which means twice the marketing effort, twice the after sales and service parts, and blah 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 blah.
I don't think getting rid of GMC is the answer, though. I think they sell the GMCs at a higher ATP, more equipment and everything. Mm-hmm. I think you have to look at the sedans, the Buicks. I mean, Buick needs a halo rear wheel drive, and maybe Verano and something in between. You look at, for example, on the car side, while Ford has done very well with the Fusion the last several years, Chevy actually has done well with the Cruze, where Ford has stumbled with the Focus, especially with its twin clutch transmission. So you know, there's some give and take there.
Mm-hmm.
The trucks are always going to sell. You have a lot of fleet sales there, and it's good fleet because it's a construction and so on. It's a good sign of how the overall economy may be improving, I hope. And B, those brands, the F-Series especially, the loyalty to that is, as Peter points out, it's a juggernaut. It's a force of itself.
I think they need to do some cherry picking in terms of what they have and what they don't have and have to go through and start calling things. Because one thing that really stood out to me is, so you look at the Buick Enclave, the Chevy Traverse, and the GMC Acadia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so three basically the same vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And the astonishing thing to me anyway is that in May, the Acadia outsold the Traverse and it outsold the Enclave by a big number.
Wow.
So it was.
But weren't sales of the Acadia down?
They were down 3.4%.
Yeah.
And Traverse down 17%.
Wow.
And the Enclave down 20%.
It isn't the new Acadia, you're saying.
They're
selling the GMC.
The GMC is outselling the Chevy.
But they're selling the standard Acadia against the Chevy Traverse, and they're selling the Acadia Denali against the Buick Enclave.
But see, the other problem for GM is, you know, it's great that they have all these vehicles coming to market, but they can't afford to market them. I mean, GM spends, they've got a huge amount of money, but when you really break it down, you know, when they want to sell Malibu, okay, well, we're going to focus on Malibu, then everything else goes down. And, you know, if they want to put some advertising punch behind Traverse will come back, but they just don't have as much money as they have in their marketing kitty. They can't seem to, they only can seem to focus on a few things, at once. And then when they don't, everything else suffers. Look at what they did with the ATS. They spent all that money on the ATS, and guess what? CTS sales dropped.
Right.
And everyone said, well, is CTS sold? No, not really. It's just they spent all the money on the ATS. I mean, so I don't know how they're ever going to resolve that. You know, but I do think fewer, better vehicles is the answer in all cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry to say that last month you and I were a little happy that the XTS was outselling the ATS.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
You were happy it was outselling the
because
ATS?
It's because they put money on ATS. So.
Yeah.
We concluded that that's a Cadillac.
Have you guys seen this new Yamaha Star Bolt, this new bike?
No.
Ben, Carmen, can you find the Yamaha Star Bolt motorcycle, a picture of it? It's so cool.
Unfortunately, we can't roll in any photos. We have a problem here.
Oh, darn it.
Well, anyway, look up the Bolt out there. You'll like it.
Star Bolt with a B.
Yeah, that's very cool.
While you're doing that, we got one more phone call. Let's bring that in.
Hey, guys. This is Auto Freelancer calling from New Jersey. I just want to say, John and Peter, great show. I've been watching it from the beginning, and thanks for keeping it real, guys. I just have a question about why the Detroit 3 automakers haven't made any mid-engine cars since the Fiero. The Fiero seems to be really popular, like a cult classic, and was popular at its time, I think. And I was just wondering why they didn't do it again. Your thoughts? Thanks, guys. Bye.
Well, I mean, GM has flirted with mid-engine Corvette for years, and they've shown some dramatic concepts, mid-engine Corvettes. But when it came time to pull the trigger, they always thought, well, it'll price the Corvette away from its original premise, which was to be a really cool car for not a bunch of money. So every time they run up against it, they ran up against it the last time with this C7.
Mm-hmm.
They had a plan B that was taken all the way, and they just pulled the plug because they think it would be too away from...
That's what Duntov wanted to do, and that's what Lutz supposedly wanted to do. You know, when you talk about the Pontiac Fiero being a cult classic, I think the key word there is cult.
Yeah, I worked on that launch.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the Fiero by the last year of production was a decent car, yeah. But that's so typical of General Motors of, you know, trying to launch something on the cheap.
Well, General Motors developed their cars in the public's hands. And I know what you're getting at, because when the Fiero...
Like Microsoft, but they did a little bit better.
Yeah.
Look, even though it wasn't mid-engine, they repeated themselves by doing a single one-generation exclusive platform called the Kappa for the Pontiac Solstice and the Southern Sky. And boy, most of our office is filled with Miata owners, including ourselves, Donna and myself, you compare the two, and there's no comparison. You know, the Miata was designed from the inside out. The Solstice was designed from the outside in, and it just didn't work. But they should be able to do something like that. They do have good designers. They have good engineers.
Yeah, they do. But getting to the viewer's question about mid-engine cars, there's been so few. I mean, actually, Ford did one. Remember, the Ford GT was a mid-engine car.
Yeah.
But if you look at sort of, and the Audi R8 is mid-engine. But the last sort of affordable one that I can think of was the Toyota MR2.
Or MR
the
Spider.
The Mr. 2.
Mm-hmm. The MR Spider as well.
But, you know, Detroit automakers, you're right, John. That Ford GT was the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a successful run.
It was. But, you know, very niche, very expensive
right.
car. And, you know, there's two issues, I think, that you get into with mid-engine cars. From a packaging standpoint, you usually end up with a car with no room in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody wants a wedge shape, you know, so there's no trunk up front where the engine would otherwise be.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing you get into is the polar moment of inertia. You go into a turn and you lift. That big lump behind you wants to swing the whole car around. And that's fine if it's a Porsche 911, you know, with people who no one expects that sort of thing to happen, at least with the older ones. But for a car available to the masses, you've got to put in so much understeer in the thing that...
But that's what makes a Boxster Cayman so much better inherently than a 911, in that its engine is between mid-engine. The wheels, mid-engine.
Not rear.
Versus rear versus the 911, and yet Porsche will hold that back because the 911 is...
But right now, the best driver's Porsche is the Cayman and the Cayman S.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But even that MR2 had, you know, lift, you know, trailing throttle lift problems.
Oh, yeah. I found that on the MR Spider on one Car of the Year drive and went around a turn and went around the turn.
Yeah.
I mean, I just spun and that's it, but...
So it would argue for having all-wheel drive capability, which would add to the complexity, which would add to the cost, which
right,
then
the
would
and I would
then begin
before
to,
all-wheel drive. I'd say all-wheel steer. You know, I think that would solve a lot of the problems with a mid-engine or rear-engine car. But I think the answer to the viewer is very few people, very few automakers have done mid-engine cars. They there just isn't that many out there.
Guess we've hit the wall again. End of another show.
Is this? I'm not a motorcycle guy, but is this the right one?
Yes.
Let's see.
Let's see that.
I'm tugging. Forgot about that.
Oh yeah, very classic design. Not modern.
No.
This is kind of retro looking.
And look at the seat too.
Is it low?
Well, it's one. There's no.
Oh.
Provisions for riders.
Unless they want to sit on the fender and pray,
home, folks.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, good point to wrap up. Good having you guys here. Interesting discussion. I want to thank all of you for having tuned in, and please join us again here next week.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.